The information contained in this episode is for informational purposes only. No material is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
We need a revolution. There's only one solution. I need somebody to show me, somebody to show me the love. We need a revolution.
And we're back here at the Liberty Hour, KKNW 1150. This is Liberty Hour of Informed Life Radio, brought to you by Informed Choice Washington. My name is Javier Figueroa.
And I'm Bob Runnels.
And we're both happy to be here to share this hour with our next two guests. Now, before we begin, I have to give a couple of disclaimers. The views expressed are not necessarily those of Informed Choice Washington or KKNW. These are our views, and these are the views of our guests. We're not giving any medical or legal advice. Please seek out qualified advisors for that. And again, this show is entirely funded by donations from listeners. If you value free speech on the air, please visit Informed Choice Washington and donate today. Consider a recurring donation and help us spread the word and keep free speech alive. Bob, we had a great hour last hour. And this section is, of course, the Liberty Hour, where we will talk about liberty, free speech, and things that help us maintain our freedoms.
Right. Yeah, I'm really excited to have this next guest on. It's very timely for many reasons, including a free speech rally in Washington, D.C. on Monday, where I think the Murthy versus Biden case is going to have another hearing. And so Children's Health Defense is sponsoring most of that rally there. And if you're in the area for D.C., head on over. But this next guest is Rick Jaffe. I was fortunate enough to meet him in the Children's Health Defense Convention in Savannah, Georgia last year in November. And one thing that he has been able to do is stand up for freedom for doctors and certainly bring up everything into the legal forefront. Now, normally on this hour, we're covering a lot of health issues, but Rick's here at the intersection of health and legal matters and protecting rights. So again, welcome, Rick Jaffe.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And so making the news last week, and you've been working on this, I think, for quite some time, but trying to find doctors who are in dire straits here in Washington State. We've had a lot of, I would call it oppression, here in Washington State, by various agencies and suppression of free speech and the ability to do what a doctor sees fit with all their education. And so, we're certainly happy to have you and explaining the lawsuit that was filed here in Washington State. I believe the title is right now Stockton versus Ferguson.
That's right. So I guess it was last Thursday we filed this lawsuit, John Stockton versus Robert Ferguson, who's the Attorney General of the state of Washington. And we also named the Executive Director of the Washington Medical Commission. John Stockton has he's got a podcast and he's been an activist, and he also played a little basketball over the years. And so that has certainly garnered some attention. And the thrust of this lawsuit is that the Washington Medical Commission is investigating and prosecuting and sanctioning doctors for speaking out in public against what you can call the mainstream COVID narrative. That is that everyone should take every COVID shot and every booster. You should only do FDA-approved on-label drugs for the COVID treatment. Wear a mask when they say so, and don't go to the beach if they tell you not to go to the beach. And that's roughly, don't take ivermectin, because despite the 100 studies that say it worked, there's studies that say it don't work. And the FDA and the manufacturers say not to take it, even though it's been given to like a zillion people for other conditions. And it's a relatively safe drug. So that's what I'm calling the mainstream COVID narrative. And Washington has taken upon itself to do something which is fairly, well, in legal parlance, I would call it crazy, fairly crazy, in that they're going after speech that public speech or what's called soapbox speech. So in one example, Doc Eggleston writes a column or used to write a column at the Lewiston Tribune. And he talks about a lot of things, COVID, and he happens to believe ivermectin works. And he's basically not a fan of the CDC and calls them out to task. So he's written in the Lewiston Tribune, some guy didn't like what he said, filed a complaint with the medical board. And the medical board investigated and then charged him for writing, I don't know, false doctrine. Right? So they charged him for moral turpitude in disagreeing with the COVID narrative. And they say he's providing COVID misinformation. The other doc is this guy, Tom Seiler, who wrote posts in a chat site. They call it a discussion group, but it's a chat site. You know, and you know, both of these guys are retired. They're retired. Eggleston never said he was licensed in Washington. You have to look him up to find out that he's licensed. So they're going after two retired physicians who were giving their opinions and stating their view of the world on COVID. And look, Dr. Eggleston's against abortion, so we talk about abortion too. So they filed this case, and our information is they have about 60 other cases that, in whole or in part, involve COVID misinformation. So go ahead.
Do they call those investigations at this point where their licenses are under review, or have they already made findings against them?
Well, some may be investigations, some may be prosecutions, and some may have resulted already in sanctions. So we don't. Well, I think we're going to find that out through discovery. But we hear there are several dozen in various stages. I mean, what I can say about our two cases, the two plaintiffs in our case, both of them are, you know, subject to hearing, have hearing dates. Eggleston's hearing was stopped. We filed a motion, Todd Richardson, is a co-counsel. Filed a motion for a preliminary injunction. We lost that, but Todd and I went up on appeal. Todd made a brilliant argument, and an appellate court commissioner granted a temporary stay, but that has since been reversed after 9 months of litigation. So, you know, I figured out we had to come up with a better strategy. We got to, you know, remember Jaws, you know, as Roy Scheider said something like, we're going to need a bigger boat. So that was kind of my thinking. We need a bigger boat. So, you know, it's not just about Eggleston. It's not just about Seiler. And frankly, it's not just about doctors. You know, this is now, as they say, this isn't my first rodeo. This is my fifth First Amendment COVID misinformation case. And for this one, I decided to do something different. You know, after doing all these cases, I realized that, yeah, okay, and I represent docs for a living. That's what I do. I represent medical mavericks. But, you know, when you think about it, the important point is not the doctor's right to speak. The important point, in Washington anyway, is the right of the public to hear people like Eggleston, right? The right to receive information. The case law seems to talk about both, but mostly it's about the doctor's free speech. So what I decided to do in this case, contrary to my other four cases, is really put front and center the rights of the public to hear information from dissenting healthcare professionals. And, you know, the truth is, it really, I didn't have to think too hard about who would be the best guy in the state of Washington, who basically stands for, you know, hard work, excellence, and focus, and who's in the fight. You know, it was kind of an obvious choice to have John Stockton be the lead plaintiff because he's had his problems. He's been pilloried in the press, you know, for not wanting to wear a mask at his games. And in case you would have asked, I mean, that's why John Stockton is the lead plaintiff. And to emphasize the fact that it's really the public's right to hear information, which in some sense is the most important one.
Right.
So in this case, yeah. So and that's really you know, why we filed the case and why it's called Stockton versus Ferguson.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting, educational for me as I read the case a couple times now, the complaint letter, and it's definitely a twist, right? So most of us in the public, lay people, in legal terms, we think free speech is the right to speak, but I really appreciate and take the fact about how you're focusing more on the right to hear the information. It takes two to tango. There are so many other analogies you can say about the communication taking place that was protected with our First Amendment and the free speech clause. You need to have the ability to listen as well as speak. And I really appreciate that.
So just a brief question for clarification. Stockton v. Ferguson, you're talking about the state attorney general? Ferguson?
Yes.
And so here is a state official making the claim, or at least making the case, that there are limits to what a doctor can say.
Oh, that's it. Oh, yeah. I mean, let's start from the beginning. All right. I mean, let's backtrack a little bit so everyone understands what's going on. So when the pandemic happened, you had all kinds of people that were criticizing what the CDC was putting out. Right. That, you know, the ventilators. I mean, there are people saying that ventilators are killing people. And, you know, the government said, oh, no, they're great, except for the fact that most of the people on ventilators died. And then there are people, you know, the way that you were treated primarily, I understand originally, was if you got COVID, unless you were really, really sick, they just send you home and you come back when you need a ventilator and then die. So as opposed to giving, you know, trying different things, like vitamins, minerals, anything. So that was mainstream. That was the standard of care. That was the gold standard of treatment. So even from back then time, people were criticizing it. They were trying HCQ. They were trying, eventually they tried ivermectin. So, and then you had Simone Gold and her doctors stand up in front of the Supreme Court and talk about these things. And then you have other doctors starting to come forward that were challenging the mainstream COVID narrative. And then what happened is people were starting to lose faith in the CDC, presumably either say because of these doctors, but maybe because all these people were dying. So what they were doing was not working. And it became clear that the ventilators were really causing, you know, killing people. So then what happened is in July 2021, the Federation of State Medical Boards, which is the trade group of medical boards, it's just some private organization that for 100 years basically decided to get representatives from every medical board in the country and, you know, make policy. In my world, I come from alternative health, and they typically just go after unconventional healthcare practitioners. And that's what they've been doing for 20 or 30 years. And I've been dealing with the effects of them for a long, long time in my practice. So they come up with a press release. It's like a 2 or 3 paragraph press release, unsupported by anything, unsupported by law. They just made this stuff up. They said, you know what? We think our member medical board should go after doctors for spreading COVID misinformation to the public. They just made this stuff up and they issued this edict. And for the next year or two, you know, there was a varying response. Some states actually were pretty offended by it, you know, because they wanted doctors to be able to speak out in public. I mean, so some states introduced bills to stop the boards from doing it. And then some states, especially in the West Coast, the big three, Washington, Oregon, and California, in various ways attempted to implement that. Colorado did too. New Mexico did. A lot of the West Coast states that are seemingly, you know, very liberal, more or less did it. Though what really happened is some of these other states, Colorado and New Mexico, they tended to focus more on practicing doctors who were doing medical acts like prescribing ivermectin. So this COVID misinformation thing really only took effect against doctors in California and the state of Washington. And other states, they focused on things like writing, you know, writing prescriptions, like this NAS case in Massachusetts. So California is interesting, and I'll talk about that for a second because it leads directly into Washington. California introduced legislation in February 2022 implementing the Federation's policy. And it covered what I call soapbox speech, public speech, speaking out in public, in writing or orally, as well as communications between doctors and patients, even though the Federation really didn't talk too much about that. Well, the reaction to California was pretty swift. You had a bunch of attorneys, me included, that wrote a lot of letters to the legislature and in public saying you can't attack public speech because it's protected by the First Amendment. And I think it did its job, because by the time of the first hearing in April, mid-April 2022, the law was revised to limit the application to communications between a doctor and a patient in the form of treatment or advice. So this whole public speech thing was basically thrown away, and that really gutted the heart of the bill, because, you know, how much effect does communications between doctors and patients have? So in a way, it kind of lost the heart of the bill. And that bill was eventually signed into law, but there were still problems with the law because First Amendment protects communications between doctors and patients. So between September and mid-December 2022, there were four lawsuits filed in the California federal courts to stop the implementation of the law. The first lawsuit, which is a case called McDonald versus, I don't know, maybe Newsom, resulted in the judge finding that it was perfectly legal for the medical board to censor free speech and sanction free speech under rational relationship test. Basically, the government can do anything it wants. It was clearly a wrong decision. My case for CHD was a plaintiff there, as along with Physicians for Informed Consent. And another case went to a hearing January 23rd, 2023, and we got an injunction on Fifth Amendment grounds. So the law was stopped 21 days after it was put into effect. And then eventually what happened is there was oral argument before the Ninth Circuit on this McDonald case where the plaintiffs lost. And the judge just excoriated the attorney general. They basically said our judge was right, the law was vague. And they also said that strict scrutiny applies, meaning that the judge was wrong in deciding that rational relationship test applies. And strict scrutiny is the kiss of death of the law. So I think they were sending a message to the legislature that, you know, they're going to lose. So in September, the legislature attempted to quietly repeal the law. And then everyone got wind of that. And the law was repealed as of January 2024. So that law is gone. The bad news is the medical board still thinks it could sanction the same conduct just under its standard of care. And so we filed another lawsuit. CHD's a member of that too, a party of that. Attempting a preliminary injunction on that ground too.
In California.
In California. So that hearing is April 1st, a couple of weeks.
Oh, wow, you're right in the middle of it. Okay.
Right. Circling back to Washington, right? So we filed this case. So after we realized that the Eggleston case may go forward, we decided that we need a bigger approach. So we filed this new case, Stockton. And probably in the next couple of weeks, we'll file a preliminary injunction motion. We'll probably get to court somewhere between mid-May and mid-June. And we'll see what the judge says. You know, as you probably know, Washington, Pete Serrano filed another case in front of the same judge last year. And, you know, that case eventually got thrown out. But I think we have a different theory and different argument. And, you know, we've already gotten one injunction. And so I'm confident that we can avoid some of the problems in that first case.
Okay. And as you're going against the actions or trying to call out the actions of the Washington Medical Commission, but the case is as the primary defendant is Bob Ferguson, the AG. Why is that?
Well, it's a technical reason. States have sovereign immunity. And a mistake that lawyers only make once in their career, present company included, is you can't name a state in a federal lawsuit because a state has sovereign immunity, 11th Amendment, sovereign immunity. You can't sue a state. That's the Constitution. So the way around that is you name a state official, right? And there's a doctrine that's evolved. I think it's Ex Parte Young, I believe it. It's an old case. It establishes a couple things. It establishes that you can sue a state official for prospective declaratory and injunctive relief, but you can't sue the state or a state official for damages, at least not in his official capacity. So it gets all kinds of technicalities. The bottom line is you're not allowed to sue the state and federal court. You can, for injunctive relief, you have to name the state officials who can implement the injunction, right? It's got to be someone with power to implement the injunction. And that would be Ferguson, who is the head person in the Attorney General's office, and they prosecute the cases on behalf of the medical board. They're the prosecutor. And the executive director is the person who oversees the administration of the staff. And another little tidbit, it's only a technical thing. I see a lot of guys, they file cases against the individual board members. I mean, I used to do that 30 years ago, but the reality is the board members don't get involved in a case until the hearing. So my practice is anyway, I name the executive director because that is the administrative staff, head of the administrative staff, who sends out cases for investigation, who their staff interfaces with the attorney general, and who ultimately authorizes the prosecution, the initiation of charges. And that's also for reasons you can't get the board members involved because that would be like a conflict and wearing two hats. The judge is the prosecutor. So for a lot of technical reasons, my cases are a little different than most. I mean, I don't name the board members, and you have to name, you know, some official in his official capacity. And it's like a legal fiction, like you're not really suing the state. So that's the simple, but I think definitive answer to why you name. And it's just not me. You see a bunch of lawsuits, you know, Joe Blow versus Inslee. Is that your governor, right? Inslee or Newsom in California. I mean, that's common practice, or the attorney general.
Okay. Well, you also list Dan Moynihan, retired but still active MD.
Right.
And there are John and Jane Does listed. How are you going to add the additional plaintiffs?
Well, we know there at some point there are about 60 docs in total. We don't know who they are. I mean, all the investigations are not publicly disclosed. What's disclosed, I think, is when the charges are filed, but there's no way you'd have to go through a list of all the doctors to figure out who, you know, who's being charged. So some of these doctors might want to join the case and might be suitable to be plaintiffs. And so I assume what I hope is going to happen is as the case progresses, the state will be forced to produce a list of these doctors and we'll send them a notice, you know, as to whether or not they want to join or not, and they'll join or they won't join.
Have any reached out in the short time since it was filed?
No, I haven't really heard anything from anyone. But, of course, the case was only filed a week ago, and we only started getting publicity on the case on Monday. So I hadn't thought about anybody, you know, calling now. But I think we're going to need the commission the judge will figure out a way, if he's going to go for this, he'll figure out a way to protect privacy or whatever. I mean, maybe we don't get the names. Maybe we just send out a letter, which the commission sends. It doesn't really matter. The answer is we think that these other doctors ought to have an opportunity to join the case if they so want.
All right. And so as you were explaining earlier, too, I'm learning a little bit about legal matters now as our healthcare is more in the legal space, healthcare decisions and so forth. But you mentioned strict scrutiny as a test basis earlier versus rational, and which is good and which is bad in this case? Or right. Can the judge basically decide, or is his hand being forced?
In constitutional law, cases are basically determined by the level of scrutiny that a judge applies to the problem. So, you know, different issues require different levels. So the courts have worked out some kind of system whereby they give rankings, right, to constitutional cases. So look, a lot of regulation, you have to do regulation. Every regulation is going to, or most of them are going to discriminate between people, right? They're going to put people on one side or the other, right? In terms of when they pass laws, this applies to you, it doesn't apply to anybody else, or in First Amendment parlance, or issues like the right to protest. So you have a right to protest, but you can't protest on any public property anytime you want. You know, they have time, place, and manner restrictions. So in constitutional law, the first question the judge asked is, what is the level of scrutiny to be applied to the government action? And there are three basic levels. Rational relationship, which is, I call it the breath of life. Once a judge says that a law or government action is subject to the rational relationship test, that means the law is going to be upheld, because any justification that the government comes up with, any justification, any conceivable justification that a judge can think of, would be enough to uphold the law. So if the judges decide, like, for example, you know, what the court did in this, you might be familiar with this sexual orientation change therapy case, Tingley, right, where doctors, certain doctors try to talk gay people out of being gay, gay conversion therapy. California and Washington passed a law barring that, right? Said you can't do that. That's a violation of medical practice. The California courts and the Washington district courts, as affirmed by the courts of appeals, said that that law, even though it involves free speech, is really professional conduct, and that law is subject to the rational relationship test, which means, you know, I mean, look, I mean, there's arguments both sides. Is it harmful? Is it not harmful? It means federal courts don't get involved. That's what it says. States do what they want. Federal courts don't involve, right? On the other hand, there's certain strict scrutiny is applied to cases in straight on First Amendment jurisprudence. There are two characteristics, each of which is sufficient for a court to hold that strict scrutiny applies. The first is, and the first dichotomy is, whether the speech is content-based or content-neutral, right? So for example, protests, right? Time, place, and manner limitations or protests are content neutral. Doesn't matter which side of the issue you are. There's a rule saying you can only protest here with a permit or at these hours. That's content neutral. All right. That would mean that rational relationship test applies. However, if they say you can't protest about voting rights, for example, that's a specific content, and that would normally be judged under strict scrutiny, because, you know, the courts don't like it when the government starts deciding what people can talk about based on the content, right? And even more to the left or right, depending on how you look at the spectrum, even a greater strict scrutiny, or the worst kind of discrimination is what's called viewpoint. So they say, look, and this, you when I say it, you know, in this context, you know what? You can protest about voting, but you can only protest if you're in favor of restricting voting rights, not if you're opposed to it. And that would be viewpoint discrimination. Bringing it back to our case, is, or our situation is, you know, a law that says you can say anything you want supporting the CDC, but you can't say anything opposing the CDC. And that's called viewpoint discrimination, which is the most egregious form of discrimination. Either of those normally gets you strict scrutiny, which if the rational relationship test is the kiss of life, the strict scrutiny is the kiss or angel of death. Almost no laws or actions that are subject to strict scrutiny are ever upheld, pretty much almost without exception. So that's why in all these cases, for all these constitutional issues, it's like the threshold or methodological battle is determinative in this case, except for the fact that there's something called intermediate scrutiny where all bets are off, right? There's intermediate scrutiny, which is still heightened scrutiny. And that's where it gets complicated, because if you just had an absolute dichotomy, you know, a black and white, you would get, it would be a lot easier, but you got black, white, and gray. And gray is where the battleground goes, and that's called intermediate scrutiny. So in what I can tell you is with 100% certainty is that in this circuit, the courts view intermediate scrutiny between the speech between a doctor and a patient. I think, and that may even be wrong, that's been criticized. The Ninth Circuit says that when the speech is the conduct, when you're using, whether you use a scalpel, this is the phrase, whether you use a scalpel or words, if you're given treatment, you're given treatment. And if you're given treatment, the board can do whatever they want, right? Rational relationship. But the courts are also pretty clear about the most robust protection is given to public speech. So what I don't get, I don't understand how the Washington Commission did any kind of analysis, because you don't got to be a legal genius to figure out that pure public soapbox speech is fully protected by the First Amendment. And you're starting like from a 20-foot hole. So, you know, the reason I told you about California is they figured it out. I mean, it's not really a close case, you know, and you know, the reality is for the last 77 years, every judge and every justice of the Supreme Court that has written about this public speech of professionals says that it's either you can't regulate it or it's subject to the most robust protection the First Amendment has to offer. So I don't know. I mean, it's like these guys in Washington respectfully just didn't get the memo.
Yeah, and that's certainly how we feel here. We it's making right. Javier laugh.
Right. I mean, it's just it's not really a close case. You know, ironically, I'll tell you this though, which is interesting. And this case is going to be precedential because the fact that what I'm talking about and all these judges, what they're saying is bedrock. This is the foundational principles to the point where we haven't really had, I don't think, federal cases on this because no one's was stupid enough to try to do this. But because of the pandemic, you know, people just went nuts, like keeping people off the beach. So somebody came up with this idea, the Federation, two paragraphs. And all of a sudden, everyone is, you know, gung-ho on this. But no serious scholar, legal scholar, is going to say you can do that. And it's just baffling how it's got to this point. And, you know, and California figured it out. All the other states figured it out. So, I mean, it just seems crazy. So it seems to me if the judge is going to reach the issue and the merits, it's not really a close case. And you know, I think the Ninth Circuit, I mean, I heard the Ninth Circuit oral argument in the McDonald case, and they flat out told the Attorney General of California representative that strict scrutiny applies to the communications between a doctor and a patient. So in law, you say a fortiori. If it applies to the communication to doctor or patient that's less protected, it surely applies to content, viewpoint, public speech. I mean, there's nothing more sacrosanct in this country than people standing up and voicing their opinions in public. That's it. In First Amendment, that's it. That's all. That is what we cherish most highly, except in the state of Washington, at least for now.
And it seems right. And with the application of strict scrutiny, when you're looking at the actual messaging, the contents, right. I guess, that, you know, the state's been getting away with what they'll do. And they haven't had a lot of pushback. We've got a very unfavorable court system to kind of put public health at arm's reach again. And again, this is just another arm of what we see here in this state. WMC, their mission is another public health mission. They, above the ability for doctors to practice medicine and the art, literally, if you look at their website, their mission is to ensure the public health. Well, I thought we had a Department of Health for that. I thought we had some other agencies.
Well, what's to your point, these are federations. These are non-governmental bodies. These are private groups that are trying to tell doctors what you can and cannot say and what is truth and what is not truth in essence.
Right. I mean, that's it. You know, I mean, it's like the truth police. So right. So I think one way I look at it, and I put in some of my other cases, you know, the medical board, you know, I don't like what the medical boards are doing in terms of ivermectin. I think they ought to be, you know, doctors ought to be able to free to use them. But at least when they regulate, you know, try to regulate people that prescribe ivermectin, at least writing prescriptions is something that medical boards do. I get that. I don't like it. I think it's wrong. You know, you can have experts, you know, against it, but that's their job. They don't have any, there's no such thing, at least, you know, unless this judge says there is, as the standard of speech. I mean, they're confusing the standard of care with the standard of speech, and the variation in Washington is that, well, it's moral turpitude. I mean, what's next? I mean, Meryl Ness, I mean, they tried the board there. They tried to, they ordered her to have a psychiatric examination. So because they thought she was crazy because she was recommending ivermectin. And this goes hand in hand, moral turpitude for disagreeing. And look, even if you're wrong, I mean, maybe some of the things Eggleston said, I mean, I understand what he's going to say. And, you know, he basically views the fact that most people who had most people who died of COVID had serious other factors, comorbidities, right? And if you take a look at the people that had no comorbidities, not that many people died. Maybe his view was like, you know, 95%. He's not necessarily wrong on that, but you know, I mean, you know, that was his view. So they went after him for that statement that said most people died, you know, from something else or some combination of else. So it's like, does that make him, you know, guilty of moral turpitude? I mean, it's just, to me, it's crazy. But that's not the craziest thing they've done. The craziest thing they've done, and I hope the judge is going to pull him out, put him on the carpet for this. So they investigate him. They look at his articles, and they ask him for further explanation of his beliefs. You know, and so he presents, you know, five or seven, you know, single space typewritten stuff, more scientific studies, more of his beliefs, further. And then they charge the guy with obstruction of justice for writing, you know, explaining his beliefs. I mean,
not to bring in another case, but that's awfully similar to what Dr. Paul Thomas experienced in Oregon. They asked him to come back with reasoning for why he can give informed consent and even talk about a delayed schedule. He came back with the study. They suspended his license.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, but he's, like I say, he had his shot and he lost. So, you know, I mean, it's not how I would have litigated the case, but you know, it's just, he did what he did. And, you know, but yeah, I think it's similar to that, but this obstruction count is just crazy on crazy.
Well, yeah, this brings on the, on the issue of, you know, well, what if you have a doctor that has a different opinion or a second diagnosis or a second opinion? Is that moral turpitude? If a doctor says, well, that diagnosis doesn't sound right. I think you should go for this diagnosis. Is that the basis that we're going to start holding doctors to now?
Maybe, but I would say I don't think they have to go there for that, for the simple reason if a doctor misdiagnoses a patient and the and 80% of the doctors agree that it was a misdiagnosis, that would be a violation of the standard of care. You wouldn't have to use moral turpitude. I'm a board lawyer. I do this for a living. So the answer is you go for the simple. You go for the simple. So same thing with recommendation for treatment. If you have one doctor, a couple experts who say that the treatment recommendation was wrong, arguably that's a violation of the standard of care.
Once again, we're here with Rick Jaffe, lawyer, and filed the lawsuit Stockton versus Ferguson last week. And thanks again for joining us. Now, again, all this kind of issue has calmed down in California, where the law has been quietly revoked or repealed, where, you know, doctors are being under attack for their speech.
Not true. The California Medical Board is still doing the same thing. Oh, they're still going after doctors, only they're using their standard of care authority. When the legislature announced it's repealing the bill, the sponsor's office said, by the way, it doesn't mean anything. We're still going to do this stuff because they have the power. The board has the power to do it under its standard of care. And then, you know, 2 days before the repeal of the law, they published the surrender of the license of the first doctor who was charged with COVID misinformation to the patient. So, I mean, they've already yanked the license of the first doctor for COVID misinformation. So we got this great victory in the injunction. So we won the battle, but there's another battle, and that's what we're going to, you know, the next thing will be April 1st when we go for the hearing on the preliminary injunction to stop the board's use of the standard of care. We're not done yet.
Right. Thank you. But I guess that they harassed this doctor, this first doctor, so that he surrendered his license rather than having it physically yanked away.
Yeah, they didn't have to go through a board hearing. She just gave up.
Go fight City Hall. English involved there. We've had a couple of doctors surrender their licenses here in Washington as well.
Right. Renata Moon, I think, is one of them. Right?
Yeah. Dr. Moon comes to mind.
And this is just from someone who doesn't understand or know the law in this regard. Is there any case where a doctor can actually sue the board for defamation or malpractice on their part?
No, you can't really. We're suing the board. I mean, and these docs are suing the board. But in terms of
within that the standard deals of care, with, right? Is that what you're asking, Javier? More about within the standard of care and whatever. I call it harassment, this stuff where they do.
The bottom line is there's a simple answer. The answer is board officials, board prosecutors, board judges, which are like the medical board decision makers, they have absolute immunity from civil liability. Prosecutors who make a decision to prosecute, I believe, have absolute immunity too. So the answer is there's no civil damage remedy against state officials, you know, acting within the scope of their responsibilities, unless there's an exception, unless they are violating a known constitutional right. All right. So you couldn't sue for defamation, but let me give you an example of what you could sue for. Right. Suppose we get the permanent injunction and it sticks, it doesn't go up on appeal, right? So we get an injunction and the law is clear that the commission can't prosecute or even investigate a doctor for COVID misinformation. If they do it again, they could be liable for civil compensatory and even punitive damage because then there would be a violation of a known constitutional right. And it might make the argument that we could now, too, even though there's not a case holding, because all these judges have said so. But that would be a little over-aggressive. And then you have to name it in the individual capacity. So we wanted to keep this simple. We want to get what we want to get, the injunction. So, but typically, and then what you can't do also, another thing you can't do, and what Paul Thomas tried to do, and you just can't do it. I mean, it's just, it was clear to me or any lawyer who's really in the field, after he got his license yanked, he sued all these guys, for whatever, defamation, breach of policy. The other thing you can't do is you can't do what's called a collateral attack on another judgment. You got one bite of the apple, not two. You lose, you lose. You can't go to another court and say, hey, they're wrong, they're bad, they violated this, with one or two exceptions, one exception being if that first court didn't have jurisdiction over the person. So if the court issued a decision without having been able to bring the person before the court, personal jurisdiction, you can do it. But otherwise, you can't collaterally attack another judgment, which is why Paul lost his lawsuit against these individual board members for the 10 things he sued them for. I lost you.
You're muted.
Sorry, I have some background noise here. I was trying to drown that out. But it's just unfortunate. I don't want to spend too much time on that case. That's outside the scope of what we have you on for today. But it just seems unfair. It seems unfair that he has damages. He lost his practice. And I just, where do you turn? But
we can. Well, I mean, the answer, and look, I mean, there's a lot of unfairness in the law. I mean, take all the people that are damaged by the COVID shot, COVID treatments. I mean, you can't sue for that because of the PREP Act. I mean, they by statute, they said, we're making a policy. And the same thing, look at it like the Vaccine Act too, the 86 Act. I mean, they said, look, we're making a policy decision. Vaccines are important. We're not going to let all these so-called wacko lawyers put the vaccine manufacturers out of business the way they put out of business the drug makers who made Benedictine or thalidomide or all this kind of thing. They just, once the PI lawyers get a hold of you, I mean, you're gone. So they're making a policy decision. We're not going to let you sue. You have to go to this crummy vaccine court. Your damages are limited, and we're going to take a dollar from every vaccine, and then we'll put it in a fund. So the government makes this policy. You can agree or disagree. And the same thing with the PREP Act. The PREP Act, that was done even before, but they say in public health emergencies, we're just not going to let people sue unless you meet some impossible standard. Kind of like a known violation of a known constitutional right. It's maybe even worse than that, but you can't sue for basically for vaccine injury. The two people that did got like $300 or something like that, some crazy number. So it's a policy.
All right. Well, back to Stockton versus Ferguson and this case with the right to hear free speech.
Right.
I see it as having wider implications. I think, like you mentioned earlier, precedential. This one seems to have much. I read through it again, and it has huge implications that would put a lot of things to rest about government censoring speech and guiding speech or doing any kind of curation of speech. And similar to where the Murthy versus Biden case is headed.
Right. Well, this case, in all likelihood, will establish the limitations of government action against the public speech of professionals.
Not just doctors, right? Me, I see.
About professionals. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's going to, this is the case that's going to establish that principle. Because, like I say, for reasons, because it's so obviously unconstitutional, I mean, this issue really hasn't gotten litigated because it's really all about the action is really about communications between doctors and patients. And you have abortion context and you have informed consent issues and all, but it's all doctor-patient stuff, and no one's, it took a one in a century health crisis to get people so excited and irrational to come up with these stupid things. I've half a mind. I mean, it bothers me about this beach thing, a couple of years later. I mean, the notion that, I don't know, in California and Washington, in Florida, even, they stopped people from going to the beach. And they literally had police. My daughter lives like a block from the beach. I mean, they had police people shooing people off the beach. And then then for a while you can go on the beach, but you couldn't stand and you couldn't be more than five people. And you had like police officers, you know, breaking up people and telling people to move along the beach. I mean, it's just insane.
Yeah, that classifies as insane. Any person looking at the situation is like, oh, there must be a lot of science behind that decision. And
right.
Show me something.
Right.
But this is an important, well, this is a question to piggyback on that. You know, we say that, you know, we have, or they made the claim that we have evidence or the science says X, Y, and C and Z. You know, with the law, it's not about the science, it's about the law. And in essence, you know, when we're talking about constitutional rights, you know, right to assemble, a right to travel unobstructed in some cases, these were, in my opinion, clear violations of civil right. Even if there was an emergency, it was still a violation. Like going to the beach.
Well yeah, I think that's great. What I think needs to happen, I wasn't involved in any of the litigation. I was doing a lot of vaccine exemption cases. But what I would like to do is maybe there's a legislative solution. I don't think one person should be able to shut down a state. And I don't think even one person with some friends in the executive branch, like the public health department, ought to be there. I think that's too much power for the executive branch. I have a simple solution. You can't shut down a state. You can't do what they're doing unless they can get, you know, 60%, two-thirds of the state legislature, period. Boom. The people have to be heard. And it's not enough that some joker got elected 4 years ago, you know, or 3 years ago. It's not enough. And it doesn't matter that is, you know, the experts in the Department of Health think that's it. You know, that's something that only the executive with the legislative branch should be able to do, period. Mm-hmm. So that would be, if I were dictator, that's what I would do. I would say that I couldn't do it. You know, you have to have and go get two-thirds of anything. But make because ultimately, I think that people ought to be able to make their own decision. And if they're going to engage in what the experts think is risky behavior, you know, they can smoke. I mean, hell, I mean, we know that, you know, smoking causes cancer, and yet we don't outlaw it. I mean, they put a warning label on it. But you know, on this kind of personal freedom issues, like now I'm not even talking about vaccines. That's, you know, that's mandatory vaccinations. But on lockdowns and on beaches, you know, people ought to be able to make their own decision for that. That ought to be, you know, much harder.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, thank you. Rick Jaffe. How do we get a hold of you?
My website, you know, send me, my rickjaffe.com or my email is rickjaffeesquire@gmail.com. I'm pretty.
Yes. Thank you for all your work. I guess we have to apologize to Lori Martin Gregory. We gave you the full hour today, and we're going to give her another chance.
Okay. Sorry about that. You know, I guess, you get me started on this stuff, and I'm just starting to get warmed up.
No, I could go on and on. We've had lots.
I live for this stuff. I mean, this is my highest and best use.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
We'll see you next time. That's been Inform Life Radio on KKNW 1150.
Are you suffering from a sinking feeling that the COVID-19 pandemic is being blown out of proportion and that nothing in the news is making any sense? If so, then there is a fact-based, science-driven news show designed just for you. My name is Del Bigtree, and I am the host of The High Wire, the world's most trusted news source in digital media when it comes to accurate, science-based reporting on the COVID-19 pandemic. From COVID-19 vaccine development to mask mandates, school shutdowns to job layoffs, The High Wire goes beyond providing you with the most accurate, evidence-based investigations. We send you links to the sources for all of our reporting so that you can further your own investigation and come to your own informed conclusions. High above the agenda-driven circus of mainstream media, we do not run. We do not hide from the truth. Instead, we walk the high wire. If you care about truth, then join us on Instagram, Twitter, Roku, and our website, thehighwire.com.
Informed Choice Washington is a nonprofit organization that advocates for healthy immunity, medical freedom, and fully informed medical consent. The right to make medical choices without coercion is fundamental to our civil liberties and a basic principle in all human rights declarations. To learn more, tune in each Friday from 3 to 5 p.m. to An Informed Life Radio and visit the website informedchoicewa.org. It's time to take a stand for medical freedom. Go to informedchoicewa.org today.